AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 high quality ingredients. And what that means is each morning when I wake up, before I do anything else, I drink AG1 to set me up for the day. It keeps me clear headed, full of energy and focused on whatever I need to do, like writing the fighting cock, for example. One scoop once a day before breakfast and that's it. I've actually found that I've not been needing coffee in the morning to get me started. I've still been drinking coffee because I love coffee, but it's not because it's like a necessity to do so. AG1 is made out of the highest quality ingredients subject to the strictest manufacturing standards. AG1 is NSF certified for sport, and this process involves exhaustive testing and verification that every serving of AG1 is exactly what you see on the label. If you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs for your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/thefightingcock. That's drinkag1.com/thefightingcock to get started. And to help the podcast. Thank you very much. Have a great day and enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more, and Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more, and Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more, and Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's the fighting. It's the fighting. Clock. It's the fighting. It's the fighting.
Hello and welcome to the Fighting Cop Podcast, a very special one. Today we're joined by Steve Tung, who's author of Turf Wars, A History of London Football. We've also got Alex from Bristol here.
Hello. Not quite as accomplished.
An in joke where we, because of
Alex's accent. We pretend that he comes all the way from Bristol because he's so eager.
I'm sure it's not a particularly difficult one to get.
So, Steve, you wrote this book, A History of London Football, Turf Wars, and it's sort of centred around the rivalry between the clubs. There are many of them in our capital city, isn't there?
Yes, the original title was actually a very dull title, like London Calling. And then fairly soon after starting the research and so on, I realised that one of the most interesting things about football in London was the way that the clubs, although they are all rooted in their own community to some extent these days, that they have from time to time moved around or been involved in proposed mergers, ground shares and so on. Some of them ancient, like Arsenal's move across London, which must have been even more dramatic at the time than it would be now. Others we've seen more recently, of course, Fulham and QPR were going to merge at one stage. Fulham and QPR and Brentford were going to merge. We've seen the ground shares involving Charlton and Wimbledon having to go to Selhurst Park and so on. So it's been one of the stories of London football from day one, partly, of course, because of the fact that there are so many professional clubs. I didn't actually write that London has more professional clubs than any other city in the world, because I've been told there are one or two others who have a claim, like Buenos Aires. But it depends, of course, how you define actual full-time professionalism or what sort of level they're playing at. But so I think we can certainly say that London is one of the most vibrant, one of the most exciting, and I've always found one of the most interesting cities in anywhere for football.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go into your book and specifically the rivalry between Tottenham and Arsenal, obviously it's a Spurs podcast. You've been a journalist for 40 years, is that right?
I'm afraid so, yes. and I was horrified to see that the date of my first match, which happened to be at White Hart Lane, was as long ago as 1957. I was very young, I should say, when my dad took me to see Spurs play Chelsea.
Yeah.
So on the basis that you support either the first team you go and see or the first team who wins the match, I could have been either a Spurs supporter or a Chelsea supporter, because Chelsea did win. It was either 4-2 or 4-3. It was a very exciting game. But typically of the time, it was a sort of Wednesday afternoon. It may even have been just before pre-floodlights at White Hart Lane. And so there were about 20,000 there, was all, for a pretty big London derby. And my only other real recollection is Les Allen, who went on, of course, as all listeners will know, to become one of the great Spurs double team, was actually playing for Chelsea at that stage, and scored a couple of the goals, father of Clive, of course, before they did a swap with Chelsea, in which Chelsea got a player called Johnny Brooks, and Spurs, I think, got by far the better of the deal. So that was a very long time ago, but even then, my dad had made it clear to me that although we were brought up, I was brought up in sort of Walthamstow Way, just about equidistant from Spurs, Arsenal, West Ham, I could have supported any of those teams, but he took me to Leighton Orient, one good Friday 1957, the date etched on my brain, when the result was Leighton Orient 1, Leicester City 5. And on the way home, he said, don't worry, they're at home again tomorrow. So I must have thought, hang on, we've just lost 5-1 at home, we've got to come back tomorrow. So we went back tomorrow for another London derby, as it happened, against a very good Fulham team with Johnny Haynes and Jimmy Hill in the second division in those days. And that was Orient 0, Fulham 2. So my Orient career has kind of gone on from then, apart from that one miraculous year when they actually got into the top division for one glorious season, 1962-63. It's been difficult for the O's, and it's one of the things I've tried to bring out in the book, that it's all very well having all these professional clubs in London, but there is a limited number of spectators and supporters and money. And so the Orients, the Barnets, the Dagenhams, I'm afraid to say even the AFC Wimbledons now, despite the tremendous strides that they've made, they're going to struggle a bit. Whereas at the other end, Tottenham, Arsenal, Chelsea, as undoubtedly the big three, as they've been for 100 years or more, and now West Ham going to their new stadium, hoping very much to make it a big four, I think the trend will be for those four to pull away from everybody else.
Is there some level of frustration then at the fact that West Ham have been so easily allowed to move into a huge stadium just down the road from Leighton Orient?
Well, yes. Barry Hearn, who was the owner of Orient at the time, basically did all he could. I think in his heart of hearts, he probably knew that he wasn't actually going to achieve anything much. He talked about financial compensation. He talked about actually sharing the stadium, which really would have been a disaster because you can't have Orient with the best will in the world playing in a stadium of 60,000 people. Mm. But it's going to make life very difficult for them. They're struggling on maybe 4,000 people at the moment. Whether or not they got out of the bottom division, it's going to be very tough. And, you know, it's been hard enough in an area with Tottenham, West Ham and, of course, Arsenal so close. And not surprisingly, when Arsenal moved across the river, it wasn't just Spurs, it was Orient. Orient were even nearer Tottenham at that time, of course, because they were in Clapton, just up the road. Yeah. They were Clapton Orient, and they were as outraged as Spurs were that Arsenal were moving onto their patch. But again, they couldn't do anything about it. And no, you do rather fear for the future, I'm afraid.
All right, so let's go into it. It's a good segue to go into the Arsenal thing. It's partly the reason why Spurs hold on to this story is for me it's actually two reasons. One, because you've got to be honest, we've been below Arsenal for so many years. And this is something we can hold over them, the fact that they were the first franchise football club. They did move, uproot their entire fan base, but their football club, found a new fan base in North London, which has already had two football clubs as it stood. It was it kind of bastardised the traditions of English football. But as a historian, I presume you are as well. It's a fair thing to say, given the fact you've gone through this book now. You know more than most, I'd imagine.
I ought to by now. Let's
say. Yeah. So how did that manifest? Why did Arsenal move from South London to North London?
Well, they were in financial trouble. I make the point that actually every London club at some stage, and the existing clubs has always had at some stage serious financial problems. But Arsenal's were serious, and one of the problems, based in Woolwich, was that for a long time they were not only the only London club in the Football League, they were the only Southern club in the Football League. You know, their nearest games were at places like Nottingham and Derby.
Was this when the North had the only professional game and there was no was it?
Oh, yes, I mean, 1888, when the league started, it was entirely North and Midlands. Arsenal got in 1893 into the second division when they were the only Southern club. They then got promoted to the first division where they were the only Southern club until 1905 when Chelsea and Orient the same season came into the second division and therefore played the first ever London derby. So Arsenal, they had these tremendous travelling costs. The local transport in South London wasn't very good. There was one fairly slow railway line that came out of London and went as far as Plumstead, where they were based. They didn't have any great rivals around London in terms of attendances and so on in that area, because Charlton weren't established at all at that stage. But they were struggling. They were often being urged to go back into the Southern League, where teams like Spurs were still operating. Spurs were very keen to get into the Football League from as early as they could, but kept being rejected on the vote every year. So Arsenal were struggling. This man, Henry Norris, who was a very ambitious, he was a politician as much as became mayor of Fulham, was heavily involved at Fulham, basically, even suggested that Arsenal should go there. He suggested a ground share and even a merger. So Arsenal could have ended up playing at Craven Cottage. They looked at places like Battersea. They looked at Haringey. But what he actually said was, imagine a place within 10 minutes of central London where you could see top-class football. And North London was what he settled upon. And Highbury was a site that became available. It was actually owned by the church commissioners. And he was able to do a deal with them. But it could have been Fulham, it could have been Battersea, it could have been anywhere. Unfortunately for Spurs, and indeed for Orient, it was Highbury that he chose.
Can you tell us a bit more about the furore at the time and what you found in your research? How much of an uproar was there?
Well, Spurs were particularly upset. Orient protested too, rather like the Olympic Stadium. And they were told, rather like the present row about the Olympic Stadium, that there was nothing in the rules which prevented it. Even some Arsenal supporters, to be fair, were upset. One of them wrote to the local paper, the Kentish local paper, and said, you used a marvellous word, which everyone will recognise. He said, you cannot franchise a football club. Mm. Woolwich Arsenal must play in Woolwich. So some of their own fans were, I mean, it wouldn't have been easy in, all that easy in those days to get from Plumstead in southeast London to Highbury. Mm. So they must have lost some of their own supporters. But for better or for worse, the move undoubtedly did pay off. For the last game in southeast London, they got about 3,000 people, although in those days the attendances were mainly estimated. And by the time they got to Highbury, the first game at Highbury was nearer 20,000. So from day one, it paid off. Whether they attracted any supporters from Spurs or not, they may well have done from Orient, and the move undoubtedly worked.
Mm. Was that precedent? Had that happened before at that scale? Or?
Well, yes. When I suggested, not in the book but on an online piece, that Arsenal were the first franchise football club, I got Arsenal supporters pointing out that Manchester United, for instance, moved across Manchester. They were like Man City. They were originally in the east of Manchester. Mm. And they moved about 9 miles to the Trafford area. So in some senses, they had moved across the city. The Arsenal supporters tried to make a case for Millwall moving from north of the river to south, although that was barely a mile or so. Millwall started on the Isle of Dogs,
yeah. Mm.
Which is partly, I think, the reason why their rivalry with West Ham developed very, very early, because it was all Dockers, yeah, of course, together. Yeah. So they just moved down to New Cross, which they felt was a more populous area, and made a success of that. And then I've heard people try to say, well, Chelsea were founded out of nothing and just moved into a ground at Stamford Bridge because the ground had been built already. And the same thing really happened with Liverpool when Everton moved away from Anfield. And so Liverpool started a club out of nothing. But I think that's a very different argument.
Yeah, I think it is.
I think, as I said, the idea of moving from southeast London to north London even today would be considered quite dramatic, and apart from Wimbledon and Milton Keynes, we haven't really seen anything as dramatic probably since.
And the fallout from that continues to this day. You know, for this season, your first time that
absolutely, yeah,
AFC and MK Dons are going to be playing in the same division.
And a little insight on that one, which I'd forgotten myself, and it must have had very little publicity at the time. Very early in the 1980s, Ron Nodes, who was quite a sort of football visionary, really, the problem being that nobody really liked many of his visions, but I think he really had the idea of a South London United. What he really wanted, I think, was Crystal Palace, Wimbledon, and probably Charlton, by the time they'd gone to Selhurst Park, all merging together as one big South London team who could challenge the North London sides. That didn't happen, but very early in the 1980s, Ron Nodes actually bought Milton Keynes City Football Club, which had previously, the very lowly club, had previously been Bletchley Town. He paid about £1 for the club, clearly with the intention that Wimbledon would go there, because it was obvious, although Wimbledon had done so fantastically well.
Yeah, yet. I've read that before. It wasn't just... There'd been musings about it on a couple of occasions, I think, before the bucket eventually got kicked, so to speak.
They realised it from early days at Plough Lane that although Wimbledon had done amazingly well to achieve what they did, there was no great long-term future for them, and on the gates they had and the ground they had, which is one of the reasons they went to Selhurst Park and so on. But that, you say, early 1980s, it could have been an even greater row about Wimbledon going to Milton Keynes even then.
I think the problem... Firstly, I like the fact that Arsenal fans don't say no, we're not a franchise club, but just say, well, we weren't the first.
But the difference the difference is what you're saying. A club has to appear from somewhere. So if Liverpool have made a club or Chelsea have made a club, a club is started from. All right, a ground may have already been built or whatever, but there's an organic reason as to why that club would start. Mm. The difference between the Arsenals and the Wimbledon is going to Milton Keynes is that the main priority was commercial priorities. Is into that's where they wanted to grow,
yeah.
And to be able to reach.
Well, by the sounds of it, it's like saying, "Well, this isn't working out for us anymore, so let's just find somewhere else and make it easier."
Hmm. Oh yes, yeah, very, very much so. Yeah, yeah.
I think I think it's an interesting thing because most club fans just want a club that represents their community locally. Certainly this is historically what it was like. I think AFC are a testament to that, is that they're not they didn't want to go to MK Dons with the hope of Premier League football and European football in the future, because that was probably what was promised to them as a way of placating, but actually they just want a football club that's representative of who they are and from the area that they support. And the further you go up in the leagues, the less relevant that is. You know, Tottenham have a huge fan base in America now. You know, it's such a global sport and so far from the foundations of the football club that it's like a strange juxtaposition between the owners of the club, who are purely focused on success because success means revenue, and fans of the club that have become indoctrinated in this idea of success, but actually, and often forget that there's something special about the traditions of which your club is built, mm-hmm. and that never moving regardless of the promises will ever be a worthwhile thing to do.
I think it's what soothes some fans. It certainly soothes me. My attitude has changed in the last, you know, as I've grown up and learnt more about how the club came about, and obviously the whole rivalry with Arsenal as well. The fact that we are not like them and didn't become the club we are the way they became the club they are now means that success for me is going and enjoying my football with a team that I can relate to. That's my success now.
Mm. Very much a local club too, in Tottenham's sense, in that although like all the virtually every club has had small grounds and then grown up and moved on, you know, they've always been around that Tottenham Marshes, Northumberland Park, and were one of the earliest to move into we call it the current ground still, can't we, at White Hart Lane. I think Craven Cottage is the only existing London ground which is actually older than White Hart Lane in terms of a London club moving in. So yes, they have been very much a Tottenham club.
And I think you see the way that White Hart Lane, maybe not Tottenham as a club from other rival fans, but I know Fulham is one of my favourite places to go to as an away day, and I know many other fans of other teams are the same thing, like going to Fulham and like coming to Tottenham for that traditional element. And you look at places like Arsenal, for example, with the Emirates, where they've lost, they've certainly lost that area of atmosphere, and it's I don't think it's any coincidence that people lean towards those types of places.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to keep banging on about Arsenal, but it's interesting to me. Henry Norris, you mentioned him briefly. He wasn't the most stand-up kind of character, was he, historically remembered?
No, very ambitious. Became mayor of Fulham, then became a Conservative MP. Was eventually banned from football activities altogether, basically for paying bungs. Some of the leading players who they brought to the very successful Arsenal team at the 1930s, five league titles in the 1930s, Alex James and others. Not only Alex James got a job in Selfridges, he got a newspaper column and a few extra pounds as well, apparently. And eventually Henry Norris was just was bombed out altogether. But he was certainly one of the most colourful but also the most controversial club chairman or owners in those days. I imagine in those days most people probably didn't even know who the chairman or the owner of the club was. Yeah. It wasn't the days of Ken Bates and Ron Nodes and the rest, who we became more familiar with. So yes, he went out under something of a cloud. But you know, in terms of Arsenal, he'd achieved pretty much what he wanted, although it took until, say, the 1930s. Don't forget, the Football League starts in 1888, and no London club actually wins the title till Arsenal in the 1930s. In fact, when Spurs became runners-up in the early 20s, that was the first time any London club had even been in the top two. So there was quite a lot of catching up to do in terms of the North West and the Midlands clubs.
Yeah, amazing. Really interesting. Just one final thing on the Arsenal thing. Was Henry Norris's anything to do with Arsenal's election? I wouldn't say promotion, but election to the top division. And can you just tell us a bit around that?
Yes,
story?
Yes, very much. The last year before the First World War, not a great year for London. The bottom two teams in the First Division were Chelsea and Spurs. Spurs were bottom. Arsenal had earlier been relegated, and so were already in the Second Division, where they finished fifth. So under normal circumstances, once football resumed after the end of the First World War, you would have expected Spurs and Chelsea to, it was two up and two down basically in those days, you would have expected Spurs and Chelsea to be relegated and the top two in the second division to come up. In fact, the Football League was going to be expanded by four clubs. Now, what has happened when it's previously been expanded, and this is the precedent argument that Spurs claimed, was that the bottom clubs had been reprieved. Although that was true, it had also involved re-elections and what the equivalent in those days of playoff matches, which were called test matches. Yeah. So it wasn't true that they'd automatically been reprieved, but it was true, as Tottenham argued, that the bottom club had never gone down. Now, Henry Norris, as well as being an ambitious man, had friends in high places, as well as, say, becoming mayor and then an MP. One of the people who signed the lease when he went to Highbury was the Archbishop of Canterbury, no less. Mm. So he did know some people. He also knew a man called John McKenna, who was the president of Liverpool and of the Football League. And at the crucial meeting where they decided how they would work out the promotion and the relegation for the new seasons, the Liverpool chairman made a speech very much in support of Arsenal, how they'd been such loyal members of the Football League for 25 years or more. Chelsea were reprieved automatically, and I think quite rightly, because there'd been a match-fixing scandal under which Manchester United had avoided finishing in the bottom two, basically by fixing a match with Liverpool for which a number of players were banned. And so it was agreed on a almost unanimous vote that Chelsea should stay in the top division. Mm. So it was then a matter of what happened to Spurs and who got promoted. And having made his speech in favour of Arsenal, the Liverpool and Football League chairman called for a vote, basically of all interested clubs. And in that vote, Arsenal finished comfortably ahead of Spurs and also comfortably ahead of teams who'd finished above them in the league in third and fourth place, people like Barnsley and Wolves, I think, who found themselves stuck in the second division as well, while Arsenal roared back into the first division for the first season after the war. So we had Arsenal, Chelsea and Spurs back in the top division.
I can feel my blood pressure going
almost 100 years ago. And the sense of injustice, as I'm sure you feel, was greatly increased.
And that adds to my justification for my hate for Liverpool now that I was talking about the other week.
Yeah.
That adds to it. Now I'm going to add that to the list.
Their fault as well.
Yeah.
But what we can do though is Spurs fans are pious if nothing else, right? Mm. We because we didn't have to move our football club. The ground is built on top of the current ground, which is the best case scenario if you have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we can remain pious and look down our noses at Arsenal because we're better in that respect, yeah. Traditionally, you know, built on solid foundations. But the fact that they got into the top division without, not through merit and through nefarious means, I would say, that there's something there. You know, they haven't been relegated.
Absolutely.
Since, and they would have come up eventually, probably.
Yeah.
Take the positives is what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right. But it's just the start of it, you know, and just everything around that club and how it's moved. Even when you think about now as going over to the Emirates and the sacrifice that they've made in terms of atmosphere, the price and structure that is now on at that ground. It's that tradition of looking for on a commercial basis as a priority. The fact that they don't spend money, and I'm sure, you know, they do spend money, but, you know, not to the level that the type of fans that they have these days, you know, so evidently want, points towards commercialism being the first port of call again.
Well, we know that.
Yeah. So that's just levels extra hate.
Ken Fryer, who was the long-serving secretary and chief executive there, once told us that had they known quite how difficult it would become and quite how expensive it would become to make the move, they would very seriously have considered staying at Highbury. So what would have happened if they'd stayed at Highbury on crowds of, little more than 30,000, and they'd seen West Ham going to a 60,000 stadium, Tottenham building a 60,000 stadium, Chelsea finally developing Stamford Bridge, deciding they just couldn't find anywhere else to move, up against their three main London rivals with basically holding almost twice as many people as they did. I think Arsene Wenger would have had even more excuses for why they were perhaps underachieving and not spending as much money as they might have done.
Maybe they moved back south again, trying to find some more space.
There'll be dead people down there that welcome them. The irony of it is that there would be uproar from Arsenal fans now if they moved down to South London. And you know, Anyway, let's move on a little bit. There's an interesting triangle between Tottenham, West Ham, and Arsenal. Huge clubs are so packed together, closely packed together, and it happens elsewhere. You know, Liverpool and Everton are literally just a mile away from each other. Dundee and Dundee United are literally at the end of the street, which is
an odd one, isn't it?
How
that came about and why they thought they could make it work, and yet I think they both struggled, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the likes of us look and say, oh, isn't it ridiculous, they should merge, and those two Bristol clubs, why haven't they ever merged, and they never get a team in the top division? And as we know, local rivalries go a bit deeper than that, and they wouldn't be prepared to countenance that any more than the Spurs and Arsenal.
It's been floated, with City and Rovers.
They don't like each other, do they?
By people that don't get it. that rivalry is... ridiculous.
Let me tell you briefly about going to interview Ian Holloway, who was great Bristol Rovers man, as you'll know. He was still on the training ground. His secretary took me up to his office and said, have a seat there. And when he came in, the first thing he said, even before he said hello, was, you can't sit in that chair, because there were two chairs in the room. One of them was red and one of them was blue. And it would have meant him sitting in the red chair.
Yeah.
And he was not going to sit in the red chair. And as I left, I don't know whether he was laying on this on a bit for me or not, but he clearly felt it. He was berating his secretary because the only pens on his desk were red pens and he wasn't going to write anything in a red pen.
Incredible.
Ian Holloway of the Bristol Rovers, man.
What side were you, red or blue?
My dad was a Bristol Rovers fan, but I used to go and watch Bristol City with my mates. I didn't care about either particularly, but the majority of my mates are Bristol City. But I'm neither really. But I've gone to two of the City Rovers derbies, and as much as you think of the most fierce Tottenham Arsenal game that you can remember, and atmosphere wise in recent times in the ground, and you know it's there's an atmosphere to it, and there's a nastiness to it, and there's an edge to it. Nothing like that. Nothing like City Rovers, I must admit, because it's lower down, and I think it's, you know, sometimes I think there's more some hardcores, maybe, I don't know, who are big on it, but it's still probably the most intimidating atmosphere I've been at.
So that's kind of, you can see where the rivalries come on the pitch and why the boards were kind of loggerheads. There's actually a fairly good relationship between Tottenham and
well,
Arsenal.
Yes, the other thing we should mention that I do go into in the book, early 1970s, when the two boards of directors sat down together and discussed building a new ground at Alexandra Park. The Alexandra Park was built as a sort of northern version of the Crystal Palace, not the actual...
Yeah.
Old exhibition centre, not the nothing to do with the football club. Mm. And it staged various sporting events. It staged greyhound racing and horse racing, sorry. But there was a lot of... It was the early 1970s, obviously. Hooliganism was on the rise. It's not a great area for public transport. No real underground service there. And basically, the local residents were absolutely horrified by the whole idea. They said, you know, even when we get 10,000 people at a race meeting at Alexandra Park, it causes chaos. But it was interesting that they should have got as far as actual discussions and sitting. There's a photograph. I've seen the cutting in the Daily Express, I think, had the exclusive story, and the directors each sitting on one side of the table looking a little bit sheepishly at the camera. But there were serious discussions about a ground share, and of course some of the media talk was very much in favour. They pointed to, as people always do, to the Italian clubs who ground share and so on, and said what a sensible move it would be. But it's just one of those things, isn't it, that hasn't caught on. If two clubs ever did it, you know, probably not Bristol as you say, but if two local clubs did ever do it in England, it would be interesting to see whether it did in the longer term catch on, but probably not the most obvious one, Arsenal and Spurs.
No, Liverpool and Everton have floated the idea, haven't they, before, because
they've got this notion of kind of the friendly derby.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, I know a set of Everton fans and they don't have much like for each other.
No.
There's a lot of disdain and
I think it's, you know, I don't think that really will, I mean, you can never say into the future, but the whole ground share thing between clubs that are that close, I just don't think it works here on the whole, because it dilutes everything that is about your football club. I can't see it.
So off the pitch, so the rivalries between fans, as Spurs fans, we always think that we're the most hated. I don't know if there's a sort of badge of pride with it.
Amongst London clubs, you mean?
Of all the London clubs, you know, we know that Chelsea loathe us, West Ham loathe us, Arsenal loathe us.
Yeah.
But, Steve, you've done some research and found that's not the case.
Well, there was a survey done only a couple of years ago. It actually followed the rather horrible incident with the Chelsea fans on the Paris Metro, you may remember, where they wouldn't let a black guy get onto the train with them. And YouGov, who are quite a respected political polling organisation, asked London clubs for their impressions of fans of the city's clubs. In fact, so they said, do you know any Fulham supporters, any Leighton Orient supporters, any Spurs supporters? What do you think of them, good, bad, or somewhere in between? And those with the most popular rating turned out to be Fulham. Arsenal, perhaps a little surprisingly, and Brentford, fairly harmless clubs like Brentford, QPR, Orient, Charlton, Crystal Palace. Right down the bottom by quite a long way were Millwall and Chelsea, followed by West Ham and only then Spurs. I mean, if you, those of us who lived through the 70s and 80s going to football in London, if you would have said, you know, which three clubs are you most wary of? Which three places would you be most wary of going to as an away supporter? I think Millwall, Chelsea, West Ham would probably have been top three. I don't remember Arsenal being involved quite so much at that stage. And it may have been that Spurs perhaps were, that the Spurs hardcore, the Spurs firm, such as it was, were more likely to be involved. In purely football terms, the Tottenham team that won the double, which of course got talked about, has always been talked about in the highest terms, were very much sort of media darlings. And that may have had something to do with it earlier. But I wonder whether, if you genuinely feel that, whether the hooliganism thing had something to do with it.
I wonder if it, I don't know, this might be way off, and I wonder sometimes, is depending on particularly polls of who's asked and then what their visions of a certain club, of how much the class structure in this country could come into it. If you look at things like, you know, people would think of areas like Fulham and nowadays of Islington in the type of Islington that we have now. You know, but then think of perhaps places like Millwall or West Ham or Tottenham, and whether that comes into it at all. What's thrown it is Chelsea being down there with Millwall probably, but I don't know. It's the first thing that struck me. I don't know how accurate that would be. But.
I'm surprised that Millwall featured so, given the fact this was only done 2 years ago.
Yes,
that Millwall still features so lowly.
Yes,
because it's not like. I mean, everyone's aware that Millwall and everyone.
But that's what I mean. I think there's almost like a prejudgment of the fact of what that type of club is about and what the story of that club is. If that makes sense, maybe.
Yeah, they've worked terribly hard. I mean, there have been a lot of good people working at Millwall who've worked terribly hard to try and offset this reputation. And then, you know, what happens? They go to Wembley for a cup semi-final or something,
yeah,
and end up fighting amongst themselves at work.
Do you know what? I was there. I was actually in a club Wimbledon where I'd taken some clients to that game that had been nominated as one of the ones that we got in this package thing, and we were in just taking these guys out. They weren't Millwall or who were they playing?
Wigan.
Wigan. Yeah, they were
fairly innocuous.
And we were in this bar, and these two Wigan fans walked past. It's Club Wembley, obviously, where it's mixed. And did a West Ham sign, these Millwall guys. And this Millwall guy came barging into this bar, like proper, if you were to do a stereotypical football hooligan, this is what this guy looked like. Grabbed this guy by the throat and was like, I'm going to cut you first. This is in like a champagne bar, right? And it was ridiculous. I've never seen anything like it. It was an experience, that's for sure.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying. I mean, I would have thought that we figured lower. And I wondered, I'm not surprised Arsenal are so high in that list of in terms of most hated, because they are quite inoffensive to some degree. And if you, like you say, when Arsenal come to Tottenham, it is thick, but mainly because of the atmosphere is thick, mainly because of the behaviour of Tottenham fans.
Yes.
Whereas Arsenal fans are pretty, very much, mostly, I want to get in this stadium and get out of it.
They hate it, don't they?
Yeah, they do absolutely loathe it. And I would too, because it really is
they called West Ham the Chicken Run, but that entrance into the part lane now is that you just really do get funneled in,
right?
And the police do it as well, don't they? They make it so that it's quite narrow,
yeah,
as well.
So it's quite nasty. But West Ham, when West Ham come, it's worse, miles worse, and their hatred of Tottenham. Where do you think that?
Maybe that's a little bit of envy.
Yep,
that's what we like.
Well, fair enough. Based on the records, you know, West Ham have still not won a league title, and of course it's all been fanned presumably a little bit by the I mean, you'd have your own views about Tottenham's approach and role in the whole Olympic Stadium thing, which seemed a little bit odd to me as an outsider, but that presumably fanned a little bit by that, and again I think probably in that case a bit of a throwback to the hooligan years, when I must have seen a few West Ham Tottenham games in those days, and would have been a bit more wary in those days, I think, than the sort of West Ham Arsenal or even perhaps Tottenham Arsenal in those days.
Mm. It's a strange one though, because I have a weird kind of begrudging, not like for West Ham, but a respect because of the type of club that they are, that they're organic and they're natural, and their fans seem to think about their club and what they hold dear the same things that I hold dear about Tottenham.
I think that's because we've had no choice.
Yeah,
it's that you have to hold on to these stuff if you're not successful, and that's my fear of becoming a successful football club, a truly successful football club, is that the success becomes all encompassing, and you know, you can forgive your traditions because look at all this great football we get to look at. But West Ham haven't, and Spurs haven't had that luxury. And do you know what, I don't think I would change it now.
No, and that's changed for me, as I was saying earlier. That's the biggest thing that's changed for me with football in general, is that, like I said, my success for me now is, like I said, the team that we had last year of kids that we can relate to, actually look like they're playing for the shirt and the rest of it. That's my idea of real success now. We get a couple of pots and trophies on the top of that, great.
Yeah, absolutely. You was and are, Steve, a journalist, and you've covered football for 40 years. Is that right?
Or I'm afraid it is, yes. terrifying
thing. He's nailing it over this whole 40 years thing, isn't he? Come on,
you're really pained expression on your face, Steve. Sorry.
That's because you've noticed 40 odd years.
It seems a long time, probably because it is a long time, yes.
And the change in football over those, because it escalated very quickly after the formation of the Premier League, but I'm wondering if you can, if people look back at it with rose-tinted goggles on or glasses on, and I long for a time where atmospheres were as raucous as they once were, and become quite insipid places, football grounds now. But was it better then?
Yeah, I mean, the very best time of all was probably the 60s. There's a fascinating look at just the number of goals scored. The highest average and numbers were right at the start of the 1960s. I mean, teams could score could concede 100 goals and still not be relegated because they'd scored 98 or something. And that, in 10 years, that disappeared completely, until within 10 years it was the lowest goal-scoring rate ever. By the start of the 70s, when Arsenal and Liverpool and Leeds were beginning to dominate things and play basically starting from the back and putting the emphasis on defence and so on, and they were setting these ridiculous defensive records, the whole thing did change then. The early 1970s were a fairly depressing time in terms of the actual football played, when Leeds were just beginning their rise to prominence. The 60s seemed to have a sort of carefree air about them. The hooliganism wasn't prevalent. I mean, I remember the very early 1960s, Orient's famous season in the top division. I went as a supporter to all the London away games, and you would stand at Arsenal, we stood on the North Bank. At West Ham, we stood on the North Bank. Just by the end of that season, I'm talking now, by the spring of 1963, you went and stood on the North Bank at West Ham as an away supporter, and you were looking over your shoulder just a little bit. But I remember that was the first year that I ever heard a group of supporters, I think it was an Everton supporters at White Hart Lane actually, that year I went to see, and the first time I'd ever seen a big group of supporters just standing together and actually chanting. They were just chanting that sort of Everton clap, 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 which most teams eventually took up. That's the first time I ever remember that kind of collective. Previously, when I went to away games with Orient before then, you just stood anywhere, and if you saw a few blue and white scarves, as were their colours in those days, you might have gone to stand somewhere near there. But you didn't feel in any way unsafe, and B, there was no suggestion that all the away supporters stood together or anything like that. So that really started in the early 60s when there were the first examples of, I'm afraid it was Millwall supporters again, you would hear of crowd trouble for the first time, which began to make things a bit tenser as we went into the 70s. The 70s became a little bit bleak, certainly early on. Attendances dropped off a bit, and then of course in the 80s, once we got the tragedies and the beginnings of all-seater stadiums, and around about sort of 85, 86 and so on, it was actually quite depressing to go anywhere really. And then once we had the Taylor report and actual all-seater grounds being instigated, then you had the problem of atmosphere and very restricted attendances. I mean, the very early 90s, very low capacities at Arsenal, West Ham, Tottenham, Chelsea, just because of the transformation. Mm. And so you got smaller crowds and so on. So it was fortunate really that on the back of, you know, the 1990 World Cup and Gazza's tears and so on, football suddenly became a bit more fashionable, but also a bit more attractive again. My one feeling about Sky was that it was actually a good thing that it was Sky and not, say, ITV who won that first contract, largely, of course, because of Tottenham's influence and Alan Sugar having what turned out to be the crucial vote, really, because of his very much vested interest, let's be honest, that enabled them to get the two-thirds majority for Sky to win the contract, which meant that, you know, plenty of people in those days, as we know, just didn't have access to Sky. Even now, they only get 1 million or 2 million for their very biggest matches, whereas, you know, the dullest England international on ITV will draw in 5 million people or so on. That what I'm saying is that if all these Premier League matches every season had all been available on ITV, for instance, I think it would have had a serious effect on attendances, and the whole thing might not have taken off in the same way. So yes, it's all changed dramatically. What's been quite amusing is suddenly to realise how fashionable it has become again. You know, in the late 1980s, if I went to a party or something and someone said, "What do you do?" I'd say, "Well, I'm a sports journalist, you know. Yeah. I do cricket and tennis and a bit of football." Whereas I remember the thing about the 1990 World Cup, I always remember going up to pick up my little girl from school, and the very elderly female the headmistress of the school, who had never shown any interest whatsoever in sport, let alone football, came rushing over to me and said, "Oh, Mr. Tung, wasn't it sad? Poor Gascoigne and England, didn't they do well?" That was, of course, after thousands of people had gathered at Luton Airport to welcome England back for coming fourth in the World Cup. That was a clearly, as everyone has said, it is perfectly true, that was a real transformation, and Sky were able to pick up on it and make the most of it.
Such a small space of time, really, 18 months or so before from that Gazza moment until really the Premier League was, I mean, it was sure it was probably being half considered anyway way before then, but the wheels were actually in motion ready for that 92. You know, kickoff.
The time was right. I don't know if they were, remember, they were talking about a lot of talk about a British league and a super. I mean, Irving Scholar at Spurs was one of the big movers. You know, the big five clubs were Arsenal, Spurs, Everton, Liverpool, and Manchester United. They were the ones who were pushing most, because they felt that it was quite wrong that everything financially should be divided up among 92 clubs. The bigger clubs wanted more of the spoils, and it could have gone any way. You know, in Europe, they finally fixed it by bringing in Champions League to ensure that the big clubs would get more games. But there was, you know, there was serious talk of a British league or some sort of Super League, a breakaway league. as it was the FA. People forget that it was actually the Football Association Premier League. The FA was supposed to be running it, and then somehow completely lost control of it and allowed basically the clubs and the Premier League themselves to take over.
I suppose with the first, I mean, we talked about being pious and there's some things that we have to hold our hands up to, and Spurs being the first team to float on the stock market, Scholla was a very forward thinking man, and a lot of people get quite angry when talking about his period at Tottenham. He did a lot of bad stuff, certainly from a match day going fan point of view, but you know, we did float, and that opened the floodgates really for company.
Great fan, I should say. I mean, I used to get on very well with him because he was very keen on LBC where I worked, and I once went to his office to interview him, and as you walked in you could hardly get in the door for the piles of newspapers which his poor secretary used to have to go through every day and literally cut out every reference to Tottenham for him. He was a genuine supporter, and although, as you say, he upset a few people, I would say he had the best interests of the club at heart.
I think so too. I mean, Martin Cloak, we talked about this a lot, and you know, there is no greater proponent for the rights of fans than Martin, and even he understood that Scholar's heart was in the right place. It was just that it kind of butted against what I think lots of fans wanted, you know, the demolishment of the East Stand, the shelf, the floating on the stock exchange, the change, the move away from club membership to corporation
client reference numbers and all the rest of it.
He was probably ahead of his time, to be fair.
No, he was.
This is the point. I think, you know, unfortunately, there's going to be an element of football now, and we've seen with the TV deal this year of how it's grown ever still, and the first transfer window going through, £1 billion being spent. Changes like this will come. Changes like, you know, another Super League or a European Super League that they've talked about before, or even small changes like Celtic and Rangers coming down into the English League and things like that. I think there's a part of it that these things will just happen, of whether course. It's 5 minutes' time or five years' time. Or
I think you accept that these things happen, change happens. It's just whether or not, it's how much of it you're allowed to pass without fight.
Yeah.
And if you don't fight ever, then...
And the Olympic Stadium was a perfect example of that, of how, you know, there was a huge amount of people, especially from the Tottenham side of it, that, you know, that was a bridge too far.
Yeah, I mean, there were people, Spurs fans, that were happy to go to Stratford.
Yeah, there was.
And if Daniel Levy and Spurs wanted that to happen, then no matter how big the protests, it would have happened. But
there has to be some, you're right, there has to be some fight to have been seen, to be heard. Otherwise, what's the point?
This has been fascinating.
It has. I could talk about this all day. I love this stuff.
You can find your book everywhere. It's in Turf Wars, A History of London Football.
Yes, most books seem to be sold online rather than in bookshops these days, but any Google of Tongue, which is a rather odd name, but the only one I've got, and Turf Wars, you'll find how you can get it.
And it looks fantastic as well. I was saying, you say judge a book by its cover, but if you're going to, this is the one to judge on because it looks fantastic.
I had nothing to do with it, but it does have a nice picture of Jimmy Greaves on the front anyway.
It does indeed. And that's Bobby Moore.
Yeah.
Bobby Moore, the one that wanted to come to Tottenham.
There you go.
Get a West Ham. I don't know if that's true. That's what I heard.
It's very true. He was desperate to get away from West Ham on many occasions. He would have loved to have gone to Derby with Brian Clough.
Yeah.
I think Arsenal were having a sniff as well. Of course, he was huge friends with Greavesy, and so he would have loved to have gone there.
Redknapp talks about it in his book as well.
Ended up at Fulham briefly instead.
Yeah. One of the things I never goad West Ham fans about. It's just almost like that. Too much.
Yeah, it's nice just to poke though, just a little poke.
But there's so much to be able to poke at with West Ham. It's just not that. I generally give that a wide berth.
We'll dedicate another podcast to that one, maybe.
Absolutely, Steve. It's been fascinating. And what's your Twitter in case someone wants to follow?
At Steve Tongue, very unoriginally.
Oh, there you go. It's easy.
All right. This has been another special of the Fighting Cock podcast. We'll be back with you on Monday. This is coming out on a Sunday. Cock. Flat face a prick, we can get sticky in
the mini sucking willy. When you're getting grilly, yeah, you're gonna bang the milli. Bang, bang.
Social Podcast Network.
When I clock out of the hospital at 6 p.m., I'm not done for the night. That's when Gamer Nurse 40 clocks in, and she's got orcs to slay. Sure, I'm playing a 13-year-old in Scranton, but he's a level 53 mage with a filthy mouth, so I need to stay on top of my game. What'd you call me? That's when I crack open a Heineken 00. Zero alcohol, but just as refreshing. So I can focus on stealing his gold before his mom tells him it's bedtime. Take that, kids.
Heineken 00. 0.0% alcohol. Now you can. Must be 21 plus to purchase. Enjoy responsibly.
Sports Social Podcast Network. 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 Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.